A couple of years ago, I think 4 or so years ago, we came together as a church and we did something really cool. At least I thought it was really cool. There were, I think, about 40 of us in the church at the time. And outside, as you walk through the lobby, on the right-hand side on the wall, you'll see a mosaic hanging there, a thing with tiles that has the mosaic logo built into it. And a couple of years ago, we got the 40 people in our church together, and as they showed up one Sunday, we were just sort of walking into who we wanted to be, and the name Mosaic, we handed each one of them a piece of tile when they walked in the door. And on the back of the piece of tile, there was a number. And they came in, they grabbed this little broken piece of tile, came and sat down, and I shared this message about what it meant to be a mosaic. And then at the end of the message, each person came up and we had this board in the back. And on the board, there were these shapes on the board that made no sense, but they had numbers in them. And your tile, the number on your tile matched a number on there and you glued it on. And when we're done gluing it on, I remember there weren't enough people in the church to glue all the pieces of tile on, so we had to have several pieces we kind of secretly glued on at the end. And as we glued it on, in this incredible picture, came together this artwork that now hangs on our wall and has hung there for the last 4 years that reminds those of us that were here back then that we are part of something that is bigger than ourselves, that when we bring our little piece to the table and glue it on to where it belongs, it creates an incredible piece of art. Back then, after we'd done that with that mosaic, trying to incorporate in why we are Mosaic Church, that we each bring our little piece to the table and together we make art for the world, God's art to the world, I preached a number of messages that played out into who we needed to be. And one of them, I read a story. And I want to read that story to you again because this story just so captures the heart in so many ways of things I hope happen here. This is what it says. It's out of one of my favorite little books as always, and this is what it says. In the early dry dark of an October Saturday evening, the neighborhood children are playing hide and seek. How long since I played hide and seek? 30 years, maybe more. I remember how I could become part of the game in a moment, if invited. Adults don't play hide and seek, not for fun anyway. Too bad. Did you have a kid in your neighborhood who always hid so good you could never find him? We did. After a while, we would give up on him and go off, leaving him to rot wherever he was. Sooner or later, he would show up, all mad because we didn't keep looking for him. And we would get mad back because he wasn't playing the game the way it was supposed to be played. There's hiding and there's finding, we'd say. And he'd say, it's hide and seek, not hide and give up. And we'd all yell about who made the rules and who cared about who anyway and who we wouldn't and how we wouldn't play with him anymore if he didn't get it straight and who needed him anyway and things like that. Hide and seek and yell, we called it. No matter what, though, the next time we would go and play hide and seek, he'd hide too good again. He's probably still hidden somewhere for all I know. As I write this, the neighborhood game goes on and there's a kid under a pile of leaves in the yard just under my window. He's been hiding for a long time now. And everybody else is found, and they're all about to give up on him and go over to base. I considered going out to the base and telling them where he's hiding so they can find him. And I thought about setting the leaves on fire to drive him out. Finally, I just yelled, "Get found, kid!" out of the window. Scared him so badly, he probably wet his pants and started crying and ran home to tell his mother. It's hard, really, to know how to be helpful sometimes, isn't it? A man I know found out last year that he had terminal cancer. He was a doctor. He knew all about dying. He didn't want to make his family and friends suffer through that with him, so he kept his secret. He died. Everybody said how brave he was for bearing his suffering in silence and not telling anybody, and so on and so forth. But privately, his family and friends said how angry they were that he didn't need them, didn't trust their strength, and it hurt that he didn't say goodbye. He hid too well, you know. Getting found would have kept him in the game, hide-and-seek grown-up style. Wanting to hide, needing to be sought, confused about being found. I don't want to know anyone. I don't want anyone to know me. What will people think if they did? I don't want to bother anybody. Better than hide-and-seek, I like the game of sardines. In sardines, the person who goes and hides, and everybody goes looking for him. When they find him, you get into the hiding place with him. Pretty soon, everybody's hiding together, all stacked in a small space like puppies in a pile. And pretty soon, everybody giggles and somebody laughs and everybody gets found. Medieval theologians even describe God in hide-and-seek terms sometimes. But me, I think God is more like a sardine player and will be found the same way everybody gets found in sardines, by the sound of laughter and those heaped together in the pile in the end. Ollie, ollie, oxen free. The kids out in the street are hollering the cry that says, come on in, wherever you are, it's a new game. And so I say to all those who hid so good, to all those still hiding, get found, kid. Ollie, ollie, oxen free. So I read that story, love that story. I read it regularly to myself to remind myself that we need to be a place where people get found all the time, where people are found because we don't give up on the game and are found because we call them out from the window, get found, kid. That's who we need to be. You know, our mission here at Mosaic Church is what? To demonstrate our passion for God. Should we do sign language? Oh, we could do it that way. Say it with me. To demonstrate our passion for God and His passion for people. That's our mission. To demonstrate our passion for God and His passion for people. We made that mission up and asked God to give that to us years and years ago, long before we grew big, long before there were people. In fact, when I was all by my lonesome self with my wife and a few other crazy people that were stupid enough to join me, that was when we came up with that mission. And it has hung with us until this day. And I stand here today to tell you that I'm asking myself again, are we still that church? Are we still that place where people walk in and they get found here and they find a place where the kids don't give up on playing hide and seek just because they're hard to find and where they're challenged to be found because of who they are in the community? I got an email the other day, a couple weeks ago actually. It was from a couple that went to our church. And they sent me a little note, very nice note, just wonderfully put. And they just said, hey, Renaud, we just wanted to tell you that we made the decision this Sunday to go and find another church. And I said, great. I mean, we weren't conversing. It was in an email. And then they said, here's the deal. Just thought you might like to know so you can keep pastoring well. We love Mosaic. We love the teaching. We love the music. We love the children's ministry. We've been coming for a year. We come every week. We sit down in the same chair. We leave every week. And what they really said was, we've never been found. We hide well. Okay, fair enough. But feels like everyone gave up on us and went and played their game. Now, they didn't put it that way. That's my eloquent way of tying it to the story. But that's what they said. Said, we never got found. We've got greeters, and we love our greeters, and they're fantastic. And they greeted us very well, but nobody really ever found us. Man, it broke my heart, gotta tell you. Yeah. We're getting big, and the easy answer would be, well, if you're not found, well, get found. We're big. We can't exactly go and run after every stinking little person who's wallowing in their ignorance. I've heard that before. I have. How terrible a response that would be, wouldn't it? Does that sound like Jesus to you? Well, there's a sheep missing. Well, at least it's only one. Still got 99 right here. We're in good shape. No, that doesn't sound like Jesus at all. So my heart was broken by that, and I was just like, man, I don't want that story to be here. I don't want that. No, that's not good enough for me. So of course, you know, I do what I do. I'm the leader here. I'm the visionary. I fix the problems, right? You're right. And so I run to the staff, and I'm like, what are we going to do about it? We got to fix everything. Something's missing. We got to create visual ways to get connected immediately. Randa Church is doing it well. Get those things in you. We got to have a clearer path for people to know how to get involved here. People have no idea how to plug in here. What are we doing? How are we doing this all wrong? Our greeters, we need them undercover. The people with badges on are neat, but we got to have some, idea after idea. Come on, we got to make it happen. Well, we got to establish new mentorship programs and new small group programs and new discipleship programs and new any other program that will work to make sure people get found in this place. Should we do those things? By all means, yes. That's our part in the story as your staff, to come up with new ways to get you, to make it easy for you to get connected. But then God begins to whisper to my heart. And He says, stop, Reno, stop. All those things, lots of churches do those things, and they do fix problems, but they don't have heart. something much bigger needs to happen. I'm like, what, God? He's like, let's get back to where we started. What is your mission? I'm like, well, to demonstrate our passion for you and your passion for people. Yes, Renaud, good. And what are the core values that come out of that? Well, we got to love you, God, and we got to love people, God, and we got to serve the world, God. And he went, yes, and who's we? I said, well, we are the church, us. And he goes, that's right, we, the church, are to love God, love people, and serve the world. And Renaud, it's October. You get to preach about loving people now. And guess what? You want to be the same church you were 4 years ago with 40 people who knew how to love people, and when people walked in, they got found because, frankly, there was 40 of us, and if you were the only one that was new, it was bad news for you. There was no hiding. So it was a luxury we had. There were no piles of leaves. Now there are leaves everywhere. And the fact of the matter is, no matter what you do as a staff, it's not going to make any difference in the end if the heart of the church is not where the heart of the church needs to be. You know, Paul wrote to the church in Corinth. The church in Corinth was planted there, and Paul left. And then for whatever reason, I think they grew pretty quickly. And in their growth and in their ignorance of things, as they got lost in the processes and the politics and the stuff of church, things started going completely haywire. So Paul writes two letters to them, 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. And he writes these letters to the church in Corinth to say, whoa, guys. I always laugh when I see a church called 1 Corinthians Church, and I'm like, really? I mean, that was the one church Paul wrote and totally corrected. You're doing it all wrong. Don't do it like the Corinthians. Got it wrong. And so Paul writes to them, and he says, listen, you're missing the point here in so many ways. And in a particular point in his letter, he writes about what the church is, what it was supposed to be, what God designed it to be, how it was supposed to function. Because you see, what was happening in the church in Corinth was this, that God was giving gifts to people, incredible spiritual gifts. There's a whole long list of them, and God was diversifying and giving gifts to each person. He was doing what he does, creating a mosaic, each person creating a little tile in them and going, oh, you're going to play this part, and you're going to be this piece of tile, and you're going to do that, and it's going to be beautiful. And in God's world, it was all about that big picture that he was creating. And you know what the church did? They made it about each individual piece of tile. Oh, guess what tile I am? I'm number 7. Which one are you? Number 3. Ooh, that's at the bottom. That's not nearly as good as number 7. Number 7 is what you want, except for number 9 over there. He's cooler than me, and I really want to be number 9. But at least I'm number 7 and not number 2. That's how it was going in the church. You got all these bickering back and forth and people demanding to have the right gifts from the Holy Spirit, not the wrong ones. They were tired of being this part. They wanted to be that part. And it all became about one thing for them. I'm here at church, and what's God going to do for me to make me special? And Paul writes into that, and he writes in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 12. I want you to turn there with me. If you have your Bibles, 1 Corinthians chapter 12. If you don't, under the chairs there's a bunch of Bibles. Grab one of those. Hey, if you don't have a good Bible at home, please take one of our Bibles. Write your name in it. Keep it for yourself. We want you to have it. So here's the deal. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, page 797 of our Bibles. 797 of our Bibles. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 of yours, if you brought your own. Here's the deal. Paul is writing here about spiritual gifts, and as I just said to you, Paul's going, guys, there's a bunch of different ones, and God uses them all, and they're all critical to the equation. And then he gives this illustration to nail it down and to bring it into a firm sense of how it's supposed to work. In verse 12 of chapter 12, on page 797 of 1 Corinthians, this is what it says. The body is a unit, though it is made up of many parts. And though all the parts are many, they form one body. So it is with Christ. Now, you might read that and go, it's a little complicated. I mean, it's not complicated at all. Think about what Paul's saying. He's saying, guys, the body is made up of a bunch of different parts. And each part is part of the body. And though they're all unique, they all function as one body. Think about what you're watching right now, okay? I am speaking to you, and my mouth is moving 100 miles an hour as my brain is communicating with my mouth to tell it what to do. My hands, on the other hand, are doing something completely different to enhance what the mouth is doing. They call that body language, and it's going on constantly, and you're watching it, but you don't even know you are. My feet are moving without me even thinking about it, because they're telling me, you've talked to these people long enough. Go and talk to those people now. And my brain is mentioning to my eyes, you didn't make eye contact with the middle group and they're feeling disconnected. So make sure you do that. And while that's happening, my lungs are going, breathe faster! The guy's running out of breath. He's going to die on the stage. And my heart's pumping 100 miles an hour to get the blood flowing through my system. And I can't even begin to describe to you what the liver's doing because I don't really know. All I know is that at this very moment, while I'm standing on this very stage, 100 different things are happening, and you think it's all just one perfect moment happening here. But it's actually all sorts of little parts doing exactly what they're supposed to do, told by the head exactly what to do, so that they can do what? Keep the whole thing working effectively. Can you imagine what would happen if one of those parts decided right now on the stage, right here, I'm done for the day? You can go ahead and keep going, but I'm taking a break. I mean, which part would it be? Well, some parts I guess I'd be okay. Others might not be so okay. But the reality is if any part actually stops working, you think, well, if the finger stops doing what it's doing, it's not a big deal. Have you ever had a finger in pain? Listen, if this thing starts going nuts on me and my brain goes, I think we lost a finger. And my brain starts going, focus on the finger. I think it's hurt. It's bleeding. And I'm going, I'm trying to preach a message here. Focus on the mouth. No, the finger, it's dying. And then that's what happens. That's why when you're in the middle of something neat and something gets hurt, everything stops. And the focus is right there, right? So the body functions as one, though it is made up of many parts. Look what Paul says. He says, so it is with Christ. For we were all baptized by one Spirit into one body, whether Jew or Greek, slave or free. We were all given the one Spirit to drink. Now, the body is not made up of one part, no, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be part of the body. See, it's talking about those people now in the body that tend to hide, that tend to say, I'm not like him, I'm not that way. I'm not as good. I'm not as cool. So I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to sit here and I'm just going to wait because I clearly am not part of this. And he says, just because you say I'm not a foot, does that mean you're not part of the body anymore? No. And look at this. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be part of the body. See, this is not speaking so much to the eye, but to the body now. Guys, just because the ear doesn't think that they mean much doesn't mean they're not part of us, does it? Doesn't mean we can ignore them or we can go, they're just an ear. Look at this. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? And if the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? I mean, it's almost insane what you're reading, isn't it? It's so out of the box that you kind of read it like it's nothing. Yeah, of course, if we were all eyes, that would be silly. But think about that for a second. Think about coming to church every week, and you're an eye. That's what you are. You bounce in here. Bring. You see perfectly. You can see. You can see everything. Problem is you can't talk, you can't hear, you can't smell, you can touch, but it's accidental because you're bumping. And really, you don't have much of a nervous system, so what are you really going to do? When you touch, you don't know you're touching. But thankfully, there's a mouth too. And the mouth's coming, and the mouth's talking 100 miles an hour. Doesn't know who he's talking to because he can't see, can't smell, can't touch, but that's what he does. He talks. So his job, his part is just to run in here and talk. And then he talks, and then he leaves and talks. And when I'm trying to talk, he's talking because that's all he knows how to do. Can you imagine what the world would be like if we were each one part? It would be pretty pathetic. I mean, it would be really scary. I think we'd all die just out of fear. And so you look at that and Paul goes, does it make any sense that that's how it would function with our bodies? Of course not. Of course not. That would be insane. So then Paul goes on to say in verse 18, but in fact, God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. See, Paul's mixing two things here. He's bringing us back to the illustration of the body, but he's actually not talking about the body, is he? He's talking about the body of Christ, because he said it's just like Christ. So he says, hold on a second. God did this. He arranged the parts of the body. He put the board up. He drew the mosaic. He put the numbers in, and then he handed the tiles out. You're number 12, you're number 27, you're number 42. If any of you don't show up, if any of you don't bring your piece of tile, if any of you don't place it on the board, then there's going to be a big gap there. And the board is not going to look the way it should look because I arranged it in such a way that you play a critical part in the equation. See what God's doing here? Look what he says. He says this. Where are we? Verse 18. But in fact, God has arranged the parts of the body, everyone, just as he wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable, we treat with special modesty. While our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has combined the members of the body so that of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lack it. So that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. What is Paul saying here? He is saying, guys, listen. We look at each other and we live in the world that says, compare yourself to everybody else. Are you better? Are you worse? Measure it up. If you're better, hang out with those people. It makes you feel good. If you're worse than them, don't hang out with them because they'll make you feel bad. So just measure yourself. And so we're constantly doing that. We're constantly measuring, who am I supposed to be and how am I different? How am I special? How am I unique? We live in a culture that says your uniqueness is what matters most. Anything that you conform to, that's just evil. Because they're going to suck you in and make you part of some big thing and you're not going to have individuality anymore. And God manages to do something extraordinary. He says, no, your individuality is the very thing that gifts the body with what I intended to have. Because you're different, because you're special, you bring to the table something that makes the body function well. And so if you're not part of the body, your uniqueness doesn't matter. Because you're just a broken piece of tile laying on the floor. But when you're part of the body and you place yourself where God has you, your uniqueness matters all the more. Because he says the bottom line is that there should be no division in the body because we are constantly seeking to play our role for the sake of what? The body. My lung does not go, I want to do something different now and don't want to be a lung anymore. Or my lung certainly doesn't go, I'm taking the day off. So you all know. Because the lung functions with a single point in mind. Got to keep breathing so that the heart can keep pumping. See, the lung serves the heart. The heart serves the blood, which pumps the blood to serve the other one. You can go on and on. Each organ, each thing functions to serve the body. Look at what it says here. This is a beautiful ending to this. Verse 26, if one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. We do not have the luxury of calling ourselves the body of Christ when there is a couple that gets lost in here and has to leave because they were never found. We do not get the luxury of saying, oh well. Because if a part of the body is suffering, then we are suffering. There is a part of this body that God brought here that had a part to play, and as they leave now, we suffer for it. Now, God's grace will in turn compensate for our suffering, but don't miss the fact that when we function in a way that some of us are not found, we suffer for it. Jesus illustrates this in an incredible way, bringing it back to from concept, we are the body, we're together, to actual action. Turn with me to John chapter 13. Go back a little ways, John chapter 13, page 748. In John chapter 13, page 748, 749 of our Bibles, there's a little verse in verse 34 that is one of the most extraordinary things, I think, as far as the functioning of the body of Christ and us as believers. Jesus is speaking to his disciples, and in verse 34 he says this, a new command I give you, love one another. There it is, Jesus' command. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Isn't that extraordinary? Jesus says the world will know that we follow Christ. They will know him because of our love for each other. And do you know what the context is of this little verse? this little speech he's giving right here, the context is what just happened in chapter 13. Go back to verse 1. It says here, it was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Watch this. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. This is a huge deal in this culture. You just did not do this. Jesus, the teacher and leader and Lord, does not wash the feet of those below him. That is below the leader. You don't do that. And look what he does. When he came to Simon Peter, verse 6, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "Do you not realize now? You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter. Sounds like my 2-year-old. "You shall never wash my feet." See, now at face value, we think, wow, Peter's so cool, isn't he? I mean, what a submissive man. He looks at his leader. He goes, "You will never wash my feet because you are the leader and I am your servant. And these other punks sitting around you just let you wash their feet like, oh, it's fine, but I'm not one of them." I mean, Peter, I'm sure, is thinking strategically, "I'm going to show, this is a test." And Jesus is waiting to see which disciple is going to go, nope, I'm not good enough for you to wash my feet. And he says that. And Jesus says to him, "Unless I wash you, you have no part of me." Oh, now he changes his tune. Oh, wrong test. Okay, change the word. "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "do not just wash my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Peter's brilliant. And at this entire time, Peter doesn't get it. See, if Peter was unwilling for his master to wash his feet, then he would be unwilling to wash the feet of anyone who was not his master. And Jesus is saying, "You miss it, Peter. I'm not trying to do something to you. I'm trying to show something to you. I will wash your feet so that you can wash the feet of those who are under you." You see, it doesn't matter who is around you, you're called to wash their feet. Because what Jesus is about to do, remember, is what? Die on the cross for them, right? That's why he said to Peter, "You do not understand what I'm doing now, but you will." Because what he's saying is, I'm going to show you the full extent of my love, not in washing your feet, no, but in dying for you. But I'm going to illustrate it right now by washing your feet. And then Jesus literally says that. He says to him at the end here in verse 13, "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you'll be blessed if you do them." See, Jesus, in that context, after he washed those feet, that's when he said to the boys, "Hey, a new command I give you. Love one another. Serve one another. Because they'll know you follow me by that." Then he went on to die for all of us, and he said to us, "Now I want you to die for each other." That's what I want you to do. I woke up this morning at 1:09 a.m. I did. To a little voice. "Daddy! Daddy!" It was my 2-year-old, Cole. Okay? I wake up, and I was not happy, I got to tell you, because I'd gone to bed at midnight. I had to wake up at 6 a.m. this morning. I got to preach 3 messages this morning, 1 tonight. I got a busy day. I don't understand what Cole's thinking. But he wakes up, and my first thought as I'm laying in bed listening to the little voice, he's potty trained now, so you got a certain amount of time. You've got to get in there and get into the potty if he's calling your name. And I'm laying there thinking to myself, why isn't Brooke moving? She knows I've got a big day, and here she lays, fast asleep. So in a little bit of frustration, I realized I definitely don't want to do a whole wet bed thing. So I jump up and I go in and I open the door and there's Colin's like, "Gotta go potty." And I'm like, all right, I'm thinking, why do we potty train these children? The diaper was so easy. And so we go in, I put him on the potty. I'm a little frustrated, not a big deal. I come back in and I'm about to put him back into bed and he goes, "Daddy, bed wet." And I'm like, "Bed wet?" I'm like, "No, it's not." And I put my hand on it, soaked, right? But I know his pants weren't wet. So I see they have little ice water cups, and the little lid wasn't on properly, and the water had just drained into the whole bed, and the whole bed was wet. So now I go from frustrated to just plain angry. I don't know who I'm angry at or why I'm angry, but I'm angry at somebody or something because it's late, I'm exhausted, the bed's wet, what do I do? So I pick Cole up, and I walk in the room, and I blame next to Brooke, and I'm like, hold the kid. And I walk back in there, and she's kind of startled awake. And I pull the sheets off the bed, and I throw them on the ground, and I grab another sheet, and I put it on the bed, and I'm like, ugh! And I go back in the room, and I grab Cole, and I put him down in his bed, and I look for the pacifier, and it's nowhere, and I'm like, ugh! Because I was hoping I could get this done quickly, because then I don't actually wake up, so I can just go right back to sleep. But at this point, I'm physically waking up, and it's not a good thing. So I go downstairs, and I find another pacifier, and I come up, and I hand him the pacifier, and I give it to him. And not the second I turn to walk out the door, he goes, Daddy! Want my water. Well, where's the water? Well, it's in the wet bed sheets because the cup's now empty. And I'm like, no! And I want to just look at him and say, no. But I know that's going to turn into crying. And all. So I turn around and I walk out of the room, and at a verbal level enough that I hope Brooke hears it, I go, darn it! I'm hoping that she goes, it doesn't sound like things are going well. Maybe she'll get up and come help. So I go downstairs. And I grab the bottle, I throw his cup in the sink, I grab the other cup, fill it up with water, I go upstairs and I hand it to him, and I'm like, there! And he's like, okay, and I walk out the door and I close it, and I go lay in bed. Brooke's awake at this point, and I lay in bed in that way to say, I'm back in bed and I'm mad. And she goes, what's the matter? And I'm breathing hard, and I'm like, I think this is exactly what I said. I said, I'm exhausted, it's 1 a.m, I've got a long day tomorrow, and I'm wide awake now. And she doesn't say a word. She's like, okay. And I'm laying there breathing hard, and I'm not even kidding. I'm not even kidding. God literally, almost in an audible voice, he goes, serving others is hard, isn't it? Just like that. Serving others is hard, isn't it? And this is not what I need to hear right now. You know, I'm like, yes, I'm preaching on serving tomorrow, and yes, it's hard, for the record. And he goes, I want you to get up and go and write that down downstairs before you forget it. Literally. So I'm like, I went downstairs twice already. And God's like, go downstairs and write it down. You're going to forget it in the morning. So I get up. Brooke goes, where are you going? I'm like, I got to go and write something down. She goes, write something down? I'm like, yes. So I go downstairs and I go to my notes and I'm like, Cole, service, hard. And I go back upstairs and I lay in bed and I just lay there thinking, serving others is hard. It's hard. Think it's easy? Think you just get to do it and it's warm and fuzzy and you come and it's just wonderful and you're going to feel good about yourself? No. You'll be exhausted and tired and burned out and wish that you weren't there and hate that the bed's wet and why do they need water and I don't understand and they're so needy and it's just, I'm over it. And hey, if they want to get found, well then by golly, get found. We've been searching for an hour. We're over the game. We give up. It's not easy to serve. It's not. So we create culture. You come to church. And this is what you do. If the preacher does a good job and you feel warm and fuzzy when you leave, you might want to stay. If the children get treated real well and they have incredible people that care for them, better reason to stay. If the music's good, well, now you're adding to the list. And eventually, you put a package together that goes, this is the kind of church I want to be part of because they meet my needs. And we walk in here, and because our baseline mindset is, does the church serve my needs? We function in that mindset. And God steps into that world where Peter said, I will not let you wash my feet because in my world we don't do that. I serve you, others serve me. Jesus said, no, I serve you so that you can serve others. And God calls to us today as Mosaic, saying, hey guys, you want to make sure that people here get found? Well, then don't play hide and seek and give up. Play hide and seek and keep playing. And hey, if you're hiding, God's whispering to you saying, just because you think you're not a foot doesn't mean you're not part of the body. Get found, kid. It's worth it. God has you here with purpose and reason. So let's take a chance, everyone. When we walk into church, what does it look like? If instead of walking in here and determining whether it was a good Sunday by what we experience walking out from what everyone's done for us, what if we determine whether it was a good Sunday by what we had the opportunity to do for others? If you walk in here and you leave and say, today I went to church and God gave me the opportunity to talk to two new people I'd never met before. And then I had a chance to clean up a little mess in the corner. And then, you won't believe it, but I could help put some chairs away. And I left thinking to myself, wow, God, I could have stayed home and watched the TV and listened to a preacher. But I went to church because at church I get to do something I don't get to do at home while I'm watching TV. I get to serve. I get to serve. And when we serve each other, we love each other, and we are about loving people, aren't we? So if we don't serve each other, we don't love each other. And if we don't love each other, then our core values are falling apart. And if they're falling apart, then our mission is gone. And frankly, we are no longer Mosaic. And I don't want to be something other than Mosaic. I want to be Mosaic, a place where people love each other so deeply that they serve each other without question. And yes, it costs them, and yes, it's hard, but it doesn't matter. Because that's what we're called to do. That's what we must do. In a year from now, if we're 2,000 or 3,000 or 5,000 or 20,000, it's going to make no difference. No difference. Or 500. The only thing that will make a difference is whether we're serving each other. Because it doesn't matter how small or big we are, this will be a horrible place if we don't, and it'll be an incredible place if we do. So, let's obey God's commands and love people, and let's do it first and foremost by serving one another. Serve each other. Serve each other. This is not complicated. When you walk in the doors, find someone you've never talked to. Talk to them. You're serving them. When you're here, if you're in the mood, go and help out with the hospitality table. You don't have to be invited. You can just walk up and say, can I help? You want to do something? Find something. Do it. Just come and serve. And that is the beginning. We, on the other hand, as a staff, will try to create thousands of avenues for you to know where to serve. And we'll keep working at that. And we're sorry we're behind the curve on that. But it doesn't mean you have to wait. It means you just start loving people by serving them. Let us become a church that serve each other. I want to close with this verse, and then I'll pray. In the book of Galatians, Paul is writing again. You don't even have to turn there. Just listen. It's one little verse. In Galatians chapter 5, this is what he says. He says this, verse 13 of chapter 5, you, my brothers, were called to be free. We talk about that all the time, don't we? Called to be free. We're in freedom. But do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. Whew. May we serve one another. We will be the friendliest church on the planet if people walk in here and there's 1,000 people ready to serve them as they watch us serve each other. Yes, let's be that mosaic.